Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hello! If it's Friday, it must be time for another episode of Strictly VC Download. We hope that you are all very well and in for a fun weekend slash week. We're seeing some friends tomorrow, which we are very much looking forward to, even though we will be outside, a safe distance away, and wearing masks. Details I am mentioning just in case my mother is listening. But before that, it has been another busy week in GoGo Startup Land, with not only the typical dozens of funding announcements being rolled out daily, but a number of more traditional Silicon Valley firms rolling out their newest funds. I talked with Phil Black and John Callahan of True Ventures, for example, about the $840 million more dollars in capital that they now have to put to work across two funds. The firm has had a really amazing track record, including by building up a position in Peloton that made it the second biggest shareholder when the company went public last fall. And as some listeners might know, Peloton was valued at $7.2 billion at the time, which was amazing. But now it's valued at $38 billion, which is really something to think about. It's really incredible the degree to which people have moved indoors to do their exercising. In fact, one of the biggest fitness companies of the last 20 or 30 years or so, 24 Hour Fitness, is in deep doo-doo. It filed for bankruptcy back in June, an outcome accelerated, no doubt, by COVID. I also talked with Venki Ganesan of Menlo Ventures, a now 44-year-old venture firm that closed on a $500 million fund, and with Lead Edge Capital, an 11-year-old firm with a colorful founder named Mitchell Green, who has a lot of dogs and cats to corral, given that the firm just closed on a whopping $950 million from an also whopping 500 investors, the vast majority of them individuals. You don't see that every day. With a lot of these firms, it's easy to think that a rising tide lifts all boats, but each really has had some outstanding success stories. Menlo with an early bet on Uber, and more recently the fintech company Chime, which is now valued at $14.5 billion, and Lead Edge Capital with the Alibaba affiliate Ant Group, into which Lead Edge has poured $160 million over the years, and that's currently expected to become the world's largest IPO when it goes out.
Twitter and Facebook knew it was coming, and yet they were still caught flat-footed. In 2016, Russian intelligence operatives used a persona known as Guccifer 2.0 to leak Democratic Party emails that had been obtained through a cyber attack. According to the Wall Street Journal, the social media giants have spent the intervening 4 years preparing for the almost certain possibility that stolen emails would once again appear on social media shortly before a presidential election. When a New York Post story appeared on Wednesday referencing emails from Joe Biden's son that were given to Trump proponents by a computer repair person, Twitter and Facebook had their long-awaited chance to show the world what they had learned. By all accounts, it was a swing and a miss. While Facebook allowed users to share the story, it suspended the delivery of these shared stories until a third party could review the accuracy of the article. As for Twitter, it blocked story shares without any explanation. On Thursday evening, Twitter's legal and policy chief, Vijaya Gadde, said the company would change how it enforces certain content rules based on, quote, significant feedback, end quote, to the way they handled the story. We will no longer remove hacked content unless it is directly shared by hackers or those acting in concert with them, she wrote, saying that Twitter instead would seek to put such material in context. We believe that labeling tweets and empowering people to assess content for themselves better serves the public interest. Nevertheless, Twitter's move did not satisfy the Senate Judiciary Committee, which plans to issue a subpoena on Tuesday requiring Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey to appear before the committee on October 23rd. Hashtag look out, Jack. Coming so close before the election on November 3rd, you can bet that Dorsey's hearing will be political theater at its finest.
Yesterday, Ryan Kaldbeck, co-founder and former CEO of the crowdfunding site CircleUp, published some ruminations about his career over the last 9 years with the startup and why he handed over the reins to a new CEO this week after alerting his board last fall that he was feeling burned out. Those ruminations on both Twitter and in a Medium post have captured the attention of many in Silicon Valley and beyond, where culturally, publicly, you keep your mouth shut about exhaustion and the toll that a company can take on your physical and mental health. In fact, because founders are under a lot of pressure to forever be crushing it, Kaldbeck's honesty must come as very refreshing to a lot of founders who have also had moments, if not years, of feeling overwhelmed by the many conflicting challenges that they face as their companies grow and age, and in some cases, as their investors grow impatient. Interestingly, in his writings, Kaldbeck made the decision to publish openly a letter he'd written last fall to a former board member and venture capitalist whose stake CircleUp eventually bought out. It paints a devastating portrait of somebody who is disrespectful, vindictive, insecure, and so self-important that the VC, according to Kaldbeck, pressured CircleUp to try and sell investors on why they should give the VC money for another fund, including prodding Kaldbeck himself to write and rewrite emails to the VC's investors and even call them to give them updates, which is not something that VCs should do or normally do. And yet, it does raise questions about what founders are sometimes dealing with behind the scenes. Just as VCs have to deal with a lot of nutty founders, the same is undoubtedly true of founders and their VCs, especially as people pour into the venture industry, many of whom have the money to invest in companies, but who may not have a whole lot else to offer.
Next up, our interview with Bradley Tusk of Tusk Ventures. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Affinity has become the new standard for managing relationships and increasing deal flow. Using patented technology, Affinity helps teams manage and grow their networks by eliminating manual data entry and unlocking introductions to key decision makers. In industries where success is contingent upon maintaining high-touch relationships, Affinity lets you get deeper insights into your network so you can more easily open doors and close deals. You can learn more at affinity.co or listen to their new podcast, Capital Connections, where they interview top investors about how their network influenced success. Find Capital Connections on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We are so happy to have Bradley Tusk here with us today. As many listeners may know, Bradley was Uber's first lobbyist and is a huge proponent of mobile voting, though you, Bradley, juggle a lot of other things, including a venture fund, an advisory business, a casino management company, and a philanthropy that has put mobile voting at its core. You also have an excellent podcast called Firewall.
Thank you.
And I know that you're a frequent guest on CNBC, a prolific writer. I have The Fixer, your book, your memoir of a couple of years ago in my office.
Cool.
And that's about your 15 years in politics, including managing the third campaign of then New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg.
Yep.
So Bradley, you make the rest of us look really bad.
No, I just have a really short attention span. And so it takes a lot of activities to keep me going.
Well, you have so many interests, but because this is largely an audience of other VCs and founders, mm-hmm. can you give us a quick snapshot of what Tusk Ventures' mandate is? Because it has bets all over the place.
Yeah, so it's a little different than probably other VCs than that. So we're an early stage fund, seed and series A. And look, when we do a deal, we look for all the same stuff that an AVC would in terms of the founder and the TAM and the idea and the underlying tech. But then we ask ourselves two questions. The first is there a gating regulatory political issue or opportunity that if it were solved could meaningfully drive growth and valuation? And if the answer to that is yes, the second question is, can we solve it? And when the answer to both questions is yes, that's when we tend to invest. So it's investing in Lemonade and then getting them their insurance licenses in every state. Investing in FanDuel and then running all the campaigns to legalize daily fantasy sports. Investing in Bird and then running campaigns to legalize electric scooters in lots of cities. Investing in Roman and then running campaigns to legalize their approach to telemedicine in all kinds of different states. So that's how we go about it. We were founded in 2016. Raising Fund One was incredibly hard because LPs all said they want a differentiated strategy. And then I would walk into their office and they're like, no, not that different. So it took me like 2 years, me and my partner Jordan, to raise it. But we did. Fund One was pretty small, $37 million, but we did 18 deals in 18 months, including really early in some companies that really worked out, like Lemonade and Bird and Roman and FanDuel. Raised Fund Two last year, $70 million. Same thesis. We now just lead about a third of the deals that we invest in. A couple of breakouts so far. Wheel, telemedicine company based in Austin, Texas, and Sunday Lawn, a organic fertilizer company based in Boulder, Colorado. And we are now in the middle of raising Fund Three.
Great. So Yes, you have had a lot of exits for such a young firm, and congratulations.
Thank you.
On Lemonade, I was just looking at the stock and I saw that it had nearly tripled in price since its IPO in July.
Yeah, although it's down today, last I checked. When you only check once in a blue moon, you're like, hey, look at how great this is. Whereas if you're checking every day, you're like, it lost 4%. Where's my money? Yeah, we got really lucky that Lemonade was our second deal that we ever did out of our first fund. And the fact that it IPO'd within 4 years of the company's founding is pretty amazing. So that's been really good. Care of, another portfolio company of ours, just was sold to Bayer. Got another exit there. There should be a pretty big FanDuel liquidity event this summer. So we've just, I think, been fortunate in that a couple of things that we did have hit pretty quickly, and that's allowed us to start returning money to our LPs, which certainly makes the fundraising process easier going forward.
Sure. Well, I mean, to your point, is it amazing that Lemonade went public in 4 years? I mean, I think it's so interesting, and it certainly is anomalous. I wonder what it says about this common complaint that the traditional IPO process is dead, or if it's just, you know, an excuse that founders and their investors make to keep companies private longer. Private. What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I've been teaching this semester at Columbia Business School, and Daniel Schreiber, who's the founder and CEO of Lemonade, was a guest in our class. I asked him that exact same question. This was 2 weeks ago. And he was very clear that he had a strategy, he and Shai Wininger, his co-founder from day one, to go public as quickly as they possibly could, because in his view, an IPO is supposed to represent kind of the beginning in some ways, right? It's the, okay, we've proven that there's a product market fit. We've proven that there's customer demand. And now let's see what we can really do with this thing. And it's supposed to be about hope and promise and future and excitement. And if you've been a private company for 10 years and you're worth tens of billions of dollars and your growth is already starting to flatten out a little bit, it's just much less exciting for public investors. It's much less exciting for the market. So I think the problem is a lot of companies, including Uber, took way too long to go public. Mm-hmm. And some of that pixie dust that is needed to really make an IPO pop has gone away. And as a result, it's just not nearly performing as well as people would have hoped. And the question now, I think, is for everyone in our business is what happens with Airbnb in a few weeks or whenever they're doing it. And will that pixie dust be there, or will they have been around for so long that the market's kind of indifferent?
That might be a good segue to SPACs, which I know that you cannot talk about yours. It was reported, or you know, I saw the filing that you were raising a $300 million blank check company to eventually target a leisure company. But can you talk a little bit about them generally? It seems that the thinking is there are so many companies that may have less pixie dust that have not gone public. You never know when the window's going to shut. Is that really the primary driver here?
No, I don't think so. Just so the listeners understand why I can't talk about it, we're still in a post-closing SEC mandated quiet period, which obviously VCs are pretty familiar with. Mm-hmm. So no, I think that SPACs have become a way to raise a lot of money very quickly. You know, it took me 2 years to raise $37 million for my first venture fund. 3 months was the entire process for me to raise $300 million on my SPAC, right? So it's a mechanism that is highly efficient and, you know, right now is so popular with public market investors that there's just a lot of opportunity out there and people are grabbing it. In fact, to the point where now you're hearing about people who are planning SPACs having to pull them back because there's just so many, you know. So I think there's a ton of competition right now. And look, there are examples, and I guess Nikola is maybe the most famous one, of SPACs taking companies public that otherwise really wouldn't necessarily have been ready to go public and having a lot of early success. Mm-hmm. But I think the fundamentals at the end of the day, you know, still kind of rule, right? If you take a really bad company public through a SPAC, maybe the excitement of the SPAC gets you kind of an early pop. But fundamentally, if this company, it neither has good unit economics nor high growth, there's no real reason to believe it's going to be that successful. And so, you know, especially for the people in the SPAC where they have to hold on to it for a little while, by the time the lockup ends, the world has probably figured out that this is not the greatest IPO of all time. So the basic rules of what a public market investor is looking for still apply. You can't put lipstick on a pig. But I think what it does do is it just creates a little bit of a frenzy where there at least becomes a new vehicle to bring companies public. And so in the same way that, you know, lots of VCs like Bill Gurley and others have been promoting direct listings over the last couple of years, I think what everyone recognizes is that the traditional IPO market is a little broken, right? In the same way that venture disrupts everything else, this is sort of a disruption of the IPO market. And right now, the investment banks make an incredible amount of money for, quite frankly, not that much work. And I think people are kind of sick of it and founders are sick of it. And so direct listings became one way to avoid some of that. And I think SPACs, while banks still do those and make money, is another way for private companies to go public without doing the traditional route.
Why did it take you a minute to raise a $300 million SPAC versus raise a venture fund? How's the investor profile in these things different?
Yeah. So the investors for the SPACs, at least when I did the roadshow, I think I did 28 meetings and over a couple of days, mainly hedge funds and people who don't really invest in venture at all. There was no overlap between my LP base and the people who invest in our SPAC that I'm aware of. So, you know, they're public market investors who are used to moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more liquidity in the SPAC, right? So we have 2 years to acquire something, but ultimately it's a public property. So investors can come in and out as they see fit. There are some really attractive pieces to a SPAC, like warrant coverage that SPAC investors get. And there's a lot of optionality. So it's a pretty logical bet for the investors because they can always get out and get their money back. And so I think as a result of all that, they just move faster. They've got a lot of money and they're dealing with big numbers. And I think, quite frankly, if I tried to raise a $37 million SPAC like I did with, you know, my first fund, nobody would have even bothered to take the meeting because it just would have been too small to even matter, you know? So, I mean, $300 million wasn't really that big. It's a decent sized SPAC, but it wasn't like at the highest end of it because those are the numbers that need to exist for these investors to really pay attention.
It's so interesting. And I appreciate your candor because I've talked to some VCs who are looking at these things and they're saying, oh, it's long only money. But it does seem to me that it's probably mostly hedge funds who also get paid management fees to deploy their capital. And this is a comparatively safe way to do it. They're getting interest on the money that's sitting around safely, you know, looking for a home.
It's like making an early stage founder bet, right? When we invest in, especially like say it's seed, we're just betting on this person. Now for us, we're also looking at some regulatory components as well, but really you're just saying, does this person have what it takes to take a idea that exists in concept and turn it into a real world company and succeed? Here, they're saying, does this person running the SPAC have enough deal flow, enough public profile, enough going on that they're going to come across the right target? And venture investors in many ways fit that profile because we just look at so many companies before deploying capital.
Do you have to demonstrate some kind of public markets expertise in order to convince some of these investors that you know what it takes to take a company public and grow it in the public markets?
Yeah, I guess we raised the money, so I guess I passed the test. Yeah. But I did spend a little under 2 years on Wall Street, created the lottery privatization group at Lehman Brothers. So, you know, a little bit of experience there. And my partner, Christian Good, has a lot of experience with big gaming companies. But overall, if you're a venture investor with a ton of deal flow and a good track record, but very little or no public market experience, I don't know that that would disqualify you from being able to raise a SPAC.
You said that your differentiation was your ability to help companies with regulatory issues. Have there been regulatory issues that you've been afraid to touch? And if so, in what areas?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, we probably see more crazy companies than almost anyone because, you know, everyone's like, hey, can I change the laws around murder or whatever? It's like, no, that's not going to work. But like one time, someone on my investment team came to me and said, this guy had this great idea. It's like the lottery, but it's just private. I'm like, yeah, that's called numbers running. Like, that's not going to happen. So there are certain sectors that I don't love. Actually, ironically, don't like GovTech. Maybe because I spent 15 years working directly in government and politics, just the notion of your entire business being based on RFPs and public procurement to me sounds kind of awful. And EdTech, in many ways, same problem, which is, yes, the K-12 school market is massive. It's $1 trillion. But there are 15,000 K-12 school districts in this country, and the smallest one is just as bureaucratic and just as political as the biggest one. And so to me, the notion of dealing with that just sounds fairly horrific. And then there are areas where we stay away simply because I don't think we add enough value. So we don't do biotech. Obviously, there's a big regulatory component with the FDA, but it's a very straightforward, singular component, which is FDA approval of this drug. And the biotech funds have gotten very good at figuring out how to do it. And there's just not enough happening that our skill set makes a real difference, or we tend to really have an advantage is, hey, I need to pass this law in 14 states, or I need to legalize this product in 23 cities. And once there's a lot of scale and there's a lot going on at the same time, that's when our system starts to really make sense. And so that's what we look for. There's a chapter in my book where I talk about a company called MyTable that was a kitchen sharing startup that I thought was really interesting, but it required basically reshaping the regulations around health inspection of restaurants. And it was a very early stage company without much money. And while I had a decent plan in my head for how it could work, there wasn't nearly enough runway to turn that into actual public policy. And they went out of business long before I was able to do anything. I've also learned the lesson that sometimes I might, in my head, think I know how to solve a regulatory problem, but I've got to be able to do it within the time frame that the company actually has. So otherwise, it doesn't matter.
If I can put you on the spot a little bit, what do you think about psychedelics?
Yeah, I'm interested in them. We've been taking meetings. We've looked at some ketamine stuff. We looked at some psilocybin stuff. Ann Arbor, Michigan, I think just was the latest to decriminalize last 2 weeks or something like that. It's coming, right? And in fact, if I could take a step back, if you have a startup that can generate new tax revenue for city and state government, this is the best time you could ever imagine, because cities and states' budgets have been decimated because of COVID. They desperately need revenue. And things that were harder sells before, like mobile sports betting or recreational cannabis or even psychedelics, are all of a sudden going to be start pushed through much, much faster simply because the revenue is so desperately needed. And if you assume that politicians always make choices based on their next election and nothing else, they might not want to deal with the political fallout of voting for recreational marijuana or sports betting on normal times. But if the alternatives are dramatically raising taxes or slashing funding for schools and hospitals, all of a sudden sports betting doesn't sound so bad. So I think that's ultimately the path that starts to put psychedelics in play, is that some jurisdiction will say, you know what, we'll take the revenue, and they decriminalize it further and legalize it further. And, you know, that's what gets the ball rolling, just like it happened on cannabis.
So Bradley, obviously one of the biggest issues you've been tackling in, I don't know, maybe the last handful of years is mobile voting. And This is an issue that you and I have talked about a number of times. And every time mobile voting comes up, your name comes up. You've become synonymous with it. But I have to ask, why are you the only person getting behind this? You have a lot of smart, powerful friends. There's a lot of really great reasons why you feel so passionately about this. I don't get it.
Oh, I haven't really recruited anyone to help me. And look, this is probably a personality flaw on my part, but I hate making decisions by consensus and having committees and all that other stuff. And at least for now, I've been able to financially bear the burden of supporting and funding mobile voting. Look, just with all due respect to other smart, rich friends that I have, I'm going to know politics a lot better than they are, right? Mm-hmm. So having to slow down and stop to explain everything all the time to me just doesn't sound that appealing. So I haven't asked anyone for help or for money or for anything else. People have offered. And I've just said, look, I'll let you know when I need it. And there will be a point where that will come, where we'll need to pass laws and 20 different states to legalize it and constitutional amendments, and it'll be hundreds of millions of dollars, and it will be more than I can handle, and I'll ask for help. But overall, we just kind of had a new milestone in our mobile voting process. For the first 2.5 years we've been doing it, we have funded elections in 15 different jurisdictions around the U.S. over 6 different states, either for deployed military or people with disabilities. And so far, so good. Turnout has more than doubled on average. Every one of those elections has been independently audited by the National Cybersecurity Center. They've all come back clean. Yes, computer scientists and others have raised objections to them, and they're not wrong about those objections. But at the same time, we've done it 15 times and nothing has gone wrong. So there's something working. But what we realized in the last 6 months or so is that the companies that are currently offering it are really good companies, but they're very early stage, very young companies. And we all know how hard it is for early stage startups to make it through the process. And so we put an RFP into the cybersecurity world saying, look, we will provide $10 million to build new mobile voting technology. It needs to be incredibly secure. It needs to be able to scale. So if millions or tens of millions of votes need to be cast on a given moment on the system, it can be done. We had the deadline, I think it was October 2nd. We got 25 submissions. They were very thorough. So we have a team of experts that will pick the winner. I don't really add much value to that process other than writing the checks. But my hope is that over the next couple of years, hand in hand with a lot of people who have been our critics, we build this new technology. Because I think if I can answer the security question pretty decisively, then when people object to doing mobile voting, their best argument is security, because they can't say what they really mean, which is, I don't want more people to vote because I have power and I don't want to have any risk of losing power. And so I think that if I can take some of our critics and turn them into our collaborators and our allies, the excuses go away and
hopefully in 2 or 3 years, we're doing this at a lot bigger scale. And by the 2028 presidential, everybody can vote this way.
I certainly hope so, because your point that it's important for democracy that more people vote has always really resonated with me. And you've always made the point that a very small subset of registered voters votes, and those are the most extreme cases who are duking it out over very polarizing issues. You mentioned that one problem is that there are a lot of small startups involved in this. So Votes being a company that you never invested in, VOATZ, but were affiliated with. So my understanding is that both Amazon and Microsoft have gotten involved to some extent. AWS, I guess, now runs state and county election registration rolls, ballot data. Can you see a day if these companies potentially work together on a solution that it might be more palatable to skeptics?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, obviously, big tech is going to have their own share of political problems, I think, in the coming years. Right. We could talk about that. But Democracy Live, which is one of the startups that does mobile voting, they run their elections on the cloud over AWS. So that's been being used in elections in South Carolina, West Virginia, Washington State, Oregon. AWS has been, at least via Democracy Live, a pretty good partner. The people at Microsoft who run their work are really against so far mobile voting. And I think the reason why is the same reason why I don't invest in GovTech. They kind of know too much in a way, which is they can't help but see everything that could potentially go wrong in terms of hacking or something else. And yet they're so politically unsophisticated that the notion of what they're protecting right now is a completely broken government and a completely broken democracy doesn't really occur to them, right? So, I mean, part of the reason why I think I have pretty different points of view than some of these people is I look at it and say 99% of elections are determined in the primary because of gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And primary turnout on average is 10 to 15%, which means the furthest left or right who actually bother to vote are the ones who dictate policy. And if you believe that every policy output is shaped by political input, which I do, and if you believe that politicians are mainly desperately self-loathing, insecure people that can't live without the validation of holding office, and they're never, ever going to do anything that risks their ability to stay in office, then you have to assume they're going to make the smart political choice on every single issue all the time and nothing else. And what we do right now is we ask politicians to defy human nature. So take guns. There's a shooting and everyone's very upset and there's hopes and prayers and vigils and calls for assault weapon bans. And then those assault weapon bans never actually happen. And the reason why is, let's say you're a Republican congressman from Florida and turnout in your primary is 12% and the district is gerrymandered, so the primary effectively is the general election. If NRA members are half that 12%, it doesn't matter that you know that people shouldn't be able to walk in off the street and buy an AK-47. You also know that if you vote for that ban, you will not get reelected. And I think for most politicians, that need for affirmation and validation is so severe that it fills a hole in their psyche that they just can't live without. It's like asking you or me to go out without oxygen or water. And so rather than hoping the politicians will defy their own interest in human nature, you got to change the incentives. And the good news is, because they're so adaptable, if turnout in a primary were 40 or 50% instead of 10 or 15%, then they're going to go with the views of that 40 or 50%. Here in New York, where I live, about a year and a half ago, Amazon tried to place their second headquarters in Long Island City, Queens, and they were run out of town, partly because Amazon ran a horrifically bad political campaign, but largely because if you look at the local elected officials from that area, the state senator, the city council member, the state rep, they read the politics correctly, which is, in their tiny little primaries with 9% turnout, where 20,000 people are weighing in on the state Senate choice, that tiny subset really does hate Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. And had they voted to allow Amazon in, they probably would have lost their seat. So while they didn't represent the collective will of their district or the city as a whole or the good of the city as a whole, they did represent the 9, 10, 12% people who show up and vote in their primaries. And so if we want a world where we can have compromise on legislation, if we can get things done on climate change or guns or immigration or education or healthcare, you have to have different political inputs to change the policy outputs. And that means turnout has to get a lot higher. And the only way you're going to do that is by letting people vote on their phone. So it's up to us to figure out how do we do it securely, not make up excuses as to why it can't be done.
It seems inevitable considering we have these phones with these biometric capabilities in our pockets. But I think I told you via email this week that in Cuyahoga County in Ohio, where my parents live, there was exactly one ballot box for people not wanting to vote by mail. Cuyahoga County is 1,200 square miles. It's home to 1.2 million people. After some pressure, they established a second ballot drop location this week. But my parents were nervous about putting their ballots in the mail because of all this talk of election chaos. It's a little afield, but I'm just wondering, do you have a point of view on whether people should be legitimately worried about this?
Well, I think there is voter suppression happening for sure. So that's number one. Number two, I'm going to vote in person because I live in New York. New York does not typically have mail-in voting. I'm not completely confident in the Board of Elections' ability here to process everything in a timely way. And quite frankly, I really want to go vote against Donald Trump. And if I had to stay in a line for 2 hours, I'll do that. But that's absurd, right? That you're asking people to take hours out of their day or risk catching COVID or rely on a system of mail that may not really work all that well when we can just all vote from our phone. We put all these unnecessary burdens on people. And the reason we do it is we don't want that many votes cast. If you have power, and that could be if you're a current elected official or whether you're the NRA on the right or the NEA on the left, you really benefit from disproportionately low turnout primaries and you don't really want it to change. And so you see all kinds of shenanigans like what your parents are experiencing. And those are very deliberate. One of the ways that we legalized Uber and ride sharing all over the US is we appeal to people of color who invariably had in their life raised their hand, seen an empty taxi, passed them right by because of the color of their skin. Literally, the very first thing I did for Uber is I wrote an ad for Black Radio saying, when you call for an Uber, no one knows the color of your finger. And that was exactly right, which is people really felt like, hey, I'd like to have a system where I don't have to worry about discrimination. And I think where this mobile voting is the same thing for voter suppression, right? You clearly have a lot of people, especially in the South, that don't want African Americans to vote because they vote Democratic. And one way to completely combat that is rather than trying to go to the polls and deal with these people, is you just pull out your phone. So I think it's inevitable. I think it's the future. I think if we do nothing, it'll happen on its own in 25 years. And I think if we work really hard and make the right decisions, then maybe we can make it happen in the next 7-8 years. But to me, that picks up a lot of extra time to try to help save this country.
I believe you were one of the few people who was very aware of Donald Trump and predicted his rise and his win in 2016. Who do you think is going to win this time around?
I do think Biden's going to win. I normally really pride myself I'm being unemotional about politics. I'm a political professional, and yeah, I'm a VC, but I grew up in politics. And I had to admit to myself finally a couple weeks ago that I'm not unemotional about this one, because I was trying to think about what would it be like if Trump got 4 more years, and I really was just having a hard time processing emotionally. So number one is, unlike normally, which I can give you pretty like objective, clear-eyed analysis, I've recognized I'm not completely there on this one. But here would be the arguments, because I was making this case a couple hours ago to a friend over text, and he was saying, well, isn't this a lot like Hillary 4 years ago? One, Biden is much further ahead than Hillary was 4 years ago. He's up by an average by 10.5 points, number one. Number two, a lot of votes have already been cast. By Election Day, there's a good chance that more than half of the total votes will have already been cast either through early voting or mail-in ballots. So the polling we're seeing is reflective of how people are voting right now. So this isn't a theoretical thing. It's actually proxy for what's actually happening. So that's number two. Number three, turnout is exponentially higher. Right? You were just seeing, based on the lines for early voting or the amount of people already voting by mail, in 2016, had turnout been even halfway decent, Hillary would have won. And she lost because people were apathetic, and she lost because people just didn't feel motivated to either vote for her or even motivated enough to vote against Trump. Whereas I think everyone has learned that lesson and is voting right now. So turnout's a lot higher. Biden has a lot of money, and there's an incredible number of independent expenditure campaigns and PACs and other organizations helping him on top of what he's already doing, whereas the Trump campaign is hemorrhaging cash and they're trying to pull TV ads. And so if you put all those factors together, I think it's exceptionally likely that Biden wins the election. So then the question is, how much does he have to win by to avoid civil unrest, right? Trump, if he can, will declare victory and will say he was cheated out of the election, and he will try to push it into the courts and hope that by having appointed 3 Supreme Court justices, and that's why the Coney Barrett nomination is being pushed through so quickly, that even if Justice Roberts doesn't side with him, he could still win in the same way that George W. Bush did in 2000. And so I don't know if that number is 6 or 8 or 10, but at a certain point, if Biden wins by enough of a landslide, Trump can't really argue it. Yes, his hardcore fanatic supporters will still say he was robbed. But if the vast, vast majority of the country, including most Republicans, are like, yeah, look, Biden won this thing, there's no question about it, I think we can escape with relatively little disruption. But if it's a 3-point race or something like that, especially in swing states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, where all of a sudden those secretaries of state are now having to do recounts and there's legal challenges, it really gets messy very, very quickly. And I think that if there's a world where it's pretty clear to most people that Biden won the election, but the courts give it to Trump, the unrest and violence we saw during George Floyd is going to be nothing compared to what's going to happen. So I really fear for our country if this election is not conducted with integrity.
Well, I have to say, though, I'm relieved at least by your points about Biden having a much bigger lead. When I saw you last in person, which I think was a couple of years ago at Skywalker Ranch, I know that you had thought at that point that Trump would get reelected. Assuming Biden wins, what are the opportunities? Who wins, who loses in a Biden administration?
Yeah, it's funny. I wrote a column for Fast Company, and I just wrote my column about this very thing today. If Biden wins and the Senate flips, because that's really the key here. And I think if Biden wins by enough, the Senate just automatically flips because the math basically works that way. Big tech is in for a seriously tough ride. I think you're going to see new antitrust legislation proposed. You're going to see a federal version of the CCPA in California or Europe's version of GDPR. I think Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act could easily be repealed. You could see national worker classification legislation, much like California has seen. The big tech companies are hated by the far left so passionately. And I don't know that Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or Joe Biden have particularly strong feelings about Facebook or Google or Amazon one way or another. But what they do know they need to do is they got to give the left something to do, and they've got to give them some wins. And if you're Biden or Pelosi or Schumer, you don't care if Facebook is one company or three. You don't care if Uber drivers are independent contractors or full-time employees. And if that keeps AOC busy and keeps Elizabeth Warren busy and all of their acolytes off your back so that you could then deal with the stuff you care about, like infrastructure or climate change or healthcare or whatever it is, I think they're going to say, have at it, right? There's no reason for Pelosi to block a lot of this stuff and use up her political capital defending big tech. Schumer is terrified of a primary from AOC in 2022, so he's going to move everything through on the left that hits the Senate. And Biden's going to sign it, both because as long as they're enacting his agenda, he doesn't really care. And this is someone who spent most of his life in Congress and believes strongly in legislative prerogatives. And so I think big tech's in for a really rough ride. However, tech and big tech are not necessarily synonymous in terms of their interests, right? You know, I invested in early stage technology companies, and we see cases where really good ideas can't get off the ground because either one of the giant tech companies squashes it or just takes it and does it themselves or buys it for a pittance and uses their market power to squeeze you out of the industry. If you want a really competitive, innovative marketplace, I think having companies that don't have monopolistic power is a good idea. And so for early stage tech, those same actions may be really helpful and really good. And as we discussed earlier, on the state and local level, tech for the last couple of years has been having a harder time from a regulatory standpoint, because when times are really good, you can fight over should the scooter be on the sidewalk or the street, right? But when you're in a global pandemic with mass unemployment, mass civil unrest, it feels really stupid to be fighting about where the scooter goes. And so I think both state and local government have to change what they're focused on, and they're going to be so desperate for revenue and for new jobs that if you can provide that, they're going to be very, very accommodating. So ultimately, if the polls hold, Washington gets worse for big tech, but maybe actually more helpful for smaller tech, and state and local gets better for tech.
And I know you're not really a thematic investor exactly, but yeah, if you were looking to, as you raise this new fund, think about new areas of investment, would you focus more on climate companies? What's going to be more interesting to you?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, if you try to look at what will likely happen if Biden wins and the Senate flips, I think privacy will happen. And so I think if you are Facebook, it's not good, but there's all kinds of early stage tech companies. We're an investor, for example, on privacy.com that enable privacy and lean into it. And I think those companies are going to be winners as a result of it. So there's an opportunity there. Climate kind of depends on how the Democrats use their big moment. If they're going to do something truly transformational, kind of the equivalent of Obamacare, it's got to happen in roughly the first 100 to 150 days. And they probably get one big swing. Personally, I hope it's climate. But, you know, if they said it's going to be healthcare or infrastructure or something else, I wouldn't be shocked. If they act on climate, then there may be all kinds of new markets created, carbon tax trading markets and offsets and all kinds of things like that. And we've been looking at companies like that. But if they say, you know what, we're going to go for infrastructure instead, and climate doesn't really get addressed in the first 6 months of a Biden presidency, Now you start getting towards midterms. People get nervous. They don't want to take controversial votes. And then if the Congress slips in the midterms, like it traditionally does, the opportunity to do transformational things goes away. So climate really depends on what choice the Democrats make with their one really, really big swing. But also the other question is, was COVID a once in 100-year thing, or are we entering an era of pandemics, right? So I would say we've had over the past decade, SARS and MERS, measles, and a bunch of other things have happened, not nearly at the same scale as COVID, but we've seen some warning signs already. And what scares me is the ROI of COVID, if you're the bad guys, was incredibly high, right? In the sense that you managed to take down the entire global economy with one virus. So I really worry that whether it's nation states or big terrorist organizations, that the lesson of COVID is, yeah, pandemics are very good if you want disruption. And so let's try to create more of these in the lab. And the minute that society becomes more interconnected again, and we're getting on airplanes and we're living the way we used to live, then the risk of spreading is incredibly high. And so if you believe that we're entering an era of pandemics and it wasn't just a one-shot thing, all of a sudden delivery drones might become really important. In the early days of COVID, when we didn't know how it was transmitted, everybody was worried about getting packages delivered because you were about the cardboard. Turns out that wasn't the problem. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be how a new virus is transmitted, right? So you may say, hey, delivery drones solve that problem because they're risk-free from that standpoint. So depending on how the world evolves, you can see a lot of the technologies that became somewhat popular over the last 6-7 months, or at least the need for them became more apparent, really do dig in and become permanent.
Bradley, I always love talking to you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me on. This was really fun.
Another one in the books. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.